one night a week, or half a night a week, actually, on the 74-inch in Richmond Hill, just north of Toronto. And only it was 15 below instead of a nice, pleasant 70 degrees. And but the rest of you were patient, but I was thinking, why can't that operator move the dome at the same time as he's moving the right ascension, at the same time as he's moving the declination? Seemed to move just one at a time. But that's the way it is. And but it took me back to my graduate school days, and we were racing the clock, and you had to be really quick to get that telescope just where it needed to be. But I guess when you have a bunch of people just looking through the telescope, it's a little different time pressure. You got lots of time. So, but it did bring back some memories. Before we get into our text in Job 38, there's a set of papers that have been published that I want to talk to you about. Because it looks like astronomers have figured out why the planets we're discovering outside the solar system look so different from the planets in our solar system. And they've actually found quite a few planets outside our solar system. It's up at 108 for sure. Maybe as many as 115 have been found, but 108 definite detections of planets outside our solar system. 13 of them that they've looked at are planetary systems, which means multiple planets going around a single star. So we have a lot of data here, but what's interesting is that all the planets we have found so far look nothing like the planets in our solar system. The techniques they're using are much more targeted to finding planets like Jupiter and Saturn. But these Jupiter-like planets are really not Jupiter-like. The main differences are they found them from 1/10 the size of Jupiter to 10 times the size of Jupiter, but they either orbit their star more closely than Jupiter does, Jupiter being the closest of the gas giants in our solar system, or they have highly elliptical orbits, which means orbits that look like this rather than circles. Or they got both. I mean, a lot of them are orbiting close and they have highly eccentric orbits. But a condition for life in our solar system is that the gas giants be far away and have circular orbits. And we've yet to find an extrasolar planet that meets that qualification. And finally, some astronomers have said, you know, this is an enigma that needs some probing. And so there are two papers that have just been published this past week that attempt to answer the question, why are all these other planetary systems we're discovering so different from our solar system? And in particular, is there any hope that we're going to be able to find Earth-like planets? Now, with the discovery of these extrasolar planets, as many of you know, there's been this extraterrestrial life optimism. Here's a direct quote from one of the papers. The discovery during the past decade of over 100 planets around other stars has encouraged many scientists to think that habitable planets like our planet Earth might be common. And indeed, that's kind of the theme that you see amongst these astronomers that are making discoveries. What is it? That's your nephew, is it? Jeff Marcy is your nephew. Good friend of a coworker. Okay, I'm sorry, I got the relationship wrong. But Jeff Marcy is probably the most prominent of the astrophysicists that has been making these discoveries. He's up here in California. And by the way, he's on our list to get the book A Matter of Days. So we'll see how he responds to that. But he, like many working in the field, have been caught up in this enthusiasm. We're finding all these planets. There must be just millions of Earth-like planets in our galaxy and other galaxies as well. Well, these two papers are casting serious doubt on that conclusion. And this one is actually a preprint. It has been accepted for publication. It's going to be showing up in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. That's probably the oldest astronomical journal in existence, started by the Royal Society in Britain almost 300 years ago. But a group of four of them, actually, British astrophysicists, have noted that these gas giants that we're finding have the characteristics that our theoretical models would predict if indeed the gas giants formed out of the same gas and dust cloud that the parent star forms. So, you know, kind of give you a quick astrophysics lesson, how stars form. You get this cloud of gas and dust, and it's gravitationally disturbed by adjoining stars, so it begins to collapse. And when it collapses to a certain stage, the gravity of the cloud takes over, and the whole thing begins to collapse until it forms a star. But as it's collapsing, it spins up. It's kind of like the ice skater effect. Thinking about the Winter Olympics now, you know, when an ice skater wants to do one of these rapid spins, what he or she will do is put out your fist like this, and then you begin a slow spin, and then what you do is you pull your fist in like this, and the conservation of angular momentum will cause the skater to spin much more rapidly. Well, this is the same thing happens with a gas cloud. As it condenses, the little bit of rotation that was there originally spins up dramatically, and therefore you get a flattened disk. And in this flattened disk, you can get planets forming out of the same gas and dust materials. And so these British astrophysicists say that really explains these gas giants that we're seeing around other stars. They form out of the same material that the star forms at the same time that the star forms, and our best theoretical models tell us that in forming in that manner, you will get elliptical orbits. It just falls right out of the mathematics that the orbits will be elliptical. And in the last half of their paper, they point out what's different about our solar system, that our solar system didn't form that way. Rather, it had the fortune of forming next to three different kinds of supernova eruptions. And supernova blow out heavy metals. And so our gas cloud that formed our solar system was enriched by all these heavy metals. And that led to a very different pathway for planetary formation. The star formed the same way as the rest of the stars form, but in this flattened disk, you get pebbles. The heavy metals will form pebbles inside the disk. And the pebbles begin to bounce into one another, and because of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, that's a 50-cent word that means barbecue tar, okay? So the tar, the sticky stuff you see in your barbecue, that's polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and it's the glue of the universe. Just like you have to really, I mean, you know how hard it is to get that stuff off of your barbecue grill? It's incredibly sticky. But that's what causes these pebbles to stick together to make rocks. Then the rocks stick together to make what are called planetesimals, and the planetesimals stick together to make rocky planets. And what these four astrophysicists are pointing out, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune are different from the giant planets we're finding orbiting these other stars, in that they all have a small rocky core. And so what happens is you get these rocky planets forming throughout our solar system. And the bigger rocks, and actually it doesn't have to be that big. It could even be one the size of the Earth. But if it's far enough away from the star, then it's cold. And because it's cold, it has the opportunity to gravitationally pull in the gas that is there. And so that really explains why we don't get gas giants close into our sun. Because these rocky cores are not going to be able to pull in this gas if it's hot. The heat of the sun will dissipate the gas. But if you get far enough away where it's cold, to pass the place where you get the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, then you can get a rather efficient condensation of gas onto the rocky core. And in this situation, what you get are circular orbits, not elliptical orbits. So what they're pointing out is we think we now have a good explanation for how our solar system forms and how all these other planetary systems we're discovering form. But then they close the paper off by saying, isn't it interesting that not a single extrasolar planetary system is like ours? And the difference is that we started off with all these pebbles, and the pebbles came from these supernova eruptions. And this is something that's in my book, The Crater and the Cosmos, is that one of the unique features of our star, the Sun, is that it formed right next to three different kinds of supernova eruptions. And it's, you know, what's the chance that a star will happen to form right next to three different kinds of supernova eruptions? By the way, you need all three. because each one of the three produces a different suite of metals heavier than helium. And you need all three suites of heavy metals for advanced life to be possible. Now, if all you want is bacteria, you can get by with two. But if you want advanced life, you need three different kinds of supernova. Now, if they explode too close to the star, they will blow the star apart, and that wouldn't be good news. But if it takes place too distant from the forming solar nebula, you will not get enough enrichment of these heavy metals. So it must form. The supernova must explode at the just right distance from the star. Well, you can work up the math in your head. What's the probability that you'll get three supernova exploding at the same time at the same distance from our star? Small probability. The other thing you've got to be careful about is the timing. If the explosions take place too soon relative to the condensation of the solar nebula, it will prevent the solar nebula from forming. But if it takes place too late, you will not get enrichment of the heavy elements into the gas dust mix. So the timing is critical for all three supernovae, and the geography is critical for all three. Bottom line is that these four astrophysicists conclude in their paper that this may indeed be the only planetary system in our galaxy that would harbor an Earth-type planet. So we could be alone as being the only one that's out there in spite of all these planets that we're discovering. Okay, that's paper number one. Paper number two looks at it from a different perspective. Question, yes.
I'm just wondering, should we just for balance say, well, I agree with all of that we're discovering the planets that are easiest to discover.
Right.
Being close to the star and or elliptical is the easiest one to discover. So we're not saying that there aren't any other systems that may have large planets more distant, just that we haven't been able to discover them.
That's true, although we do have two observing techniques that today can find planets as small as the Earth. And so far they've come up with nothing. You say, well, what are those? Well, there was one member of the class here. He's no longer here because he's doing a postdoctoral fellowship somewhere else. But you may remember Eric Agol was here in the class for a little while. He was a Caltech astrophysicist. And his research specialty was using double gravitational lenses to find planets like the Earth. And you know, a gravitational lens acts like a magnifying glass. A quick lesson. Any massive body, according to the theory of general relativity, will bend light as the light beam goes around that massive body. And so that means a massive body can act like a lens to magnify the light of objects behind it, providing you get it in a perfect line of sight. What it requires is you've got the telescope here, this massive body, and then an object you're imaging it directly behind that massive body. Then you can work like a lens. But what Eric Agol was working on were double gravitational lenses, where you've got a massive body, and you've got a line of sight to an object that you're imaging, and in between the object you're imaging and the telescope are two gravitational lenses perfectly lined up. And I say the probability of finding that has got to be pretty remote. But what he did is he steered his telescope towards the galactic center. The advantage of going to the galactic center, that's a place that's extremely dense with stars. Half the stars in our galaxy are in the bulge, the central bulge of our galaxy. And he determined that there is a fairly good probability of getting lots of these double gravitational lenses. And with a double gravitational lens, you've got a telescope powerful enough to image planets as tiny as the Earth. And so their expectation was that if Earth-sized planets are as common as these gas giants are, which is what our solar system looks like, then we should be finding a bunch of these things. So far, nothing. So this paper that I just talked about may explain why we're not finding anything by that technique. The other technique is the transit technique. Remember when Venus went across it was a transit of Venus across the Sun? Yeah, you wait 8 more years, we're going to get another one. And then you got to wait, 120 some odd years to get the next one. But the interesting thing was a planet as tiny as Venus does make a measurable depreciation in the light you get from the sun. As tiny as a dot as it is, we have instruments that are sensitive enough to the light output of a star that we can measure the drop from a transit. And so there's a group of astronomers that are looking at stars for transiting small planets. And they actually have found a few, but there's nothing coming in like Venus or Earth at this point yet. And again, if these planets were common, we should be seeing them by now, and we're not. So this paper may explain why we're not finding these expected things, because, yes, question? Well, some of them are as far away from their star as Jupiter is. But those that are as far away from the star as Jupiter is have highly elliptical orbits. Right. There's lots. Okay, it's a little more complex than what I described, namely that these, you know, the traditional way or the easy way for planets to form, where they form in the same gas cloud that the star forms, you will get these gas giants. However, with their elliptical orbits and highly inclined orbits, and if there's still stuff left in the gas cloud, the gas giants will gravitationally interact with a little bit of gas and dust that's still left in the cloud. And it's that interaction which causes the gas giants to drift from their places where they form in towards their star. In fact, astronomers have seen a number of stars that have been, quote, self-polluted, which means that the gas giants that formed actually moved so far towards into the sun, they crashed into the sun. So there have been these apparent crashes that have taken place. Now, in the case of our solar system, the gas giants drifted very little because they formed from pebbles rather than from the gas. I mean, it would have been gas far enough out. But essentially, planetary formation took place on a different time scale than would have been the case with these other gas or these other extrasolar planetary systems we're looking at. And so with the gas and dust not present, you're not going to get that drift taking place. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune would have collected what gas there was there, made their size. There would have been a little bit of drift, but not anything like what we're seeing with these extrasolar planetary systems. We do know that Jupiter's drifted in quite a bit, but as soon as the gas and dust is exhausted, it stops drifting. So that's kind of a design feature for Jupiter, is that if it doesn't drift in enough, you've got a problem. If it drifts in too far, you also have a problem. If it doesn't drift in enough, Jupiter will not have adequate mass and distance from the Earth to protect us from collisions from comets and asteroids. And if it drifts in too far, then its gravity will disrupt the orbit of planet Earth. Well, maybe I need to explain this. Yeah. Okay, that's what you're after. If a Jupiter-type planet forms far away from its star and drifts in towards its star, it keeps the gas. It doesn't lose the gas because that gas is tightly bound to the planet. However, if you've got a rocky core at the distance of Earth, it's not going to be able to gravitationally collect gas because the sun's radiation will be strong enough to prevent that from happening. But if you get far enough away, as in the case of Jupiter, Uranus, Neptune, the radiation from the sun is too weak to prevent the collection of that gas. And so this is the whole point here. In our solar system, pebbles coalesce to make rocks. Rocks coalesce to make planetesimals. Planetesimals coalesce to make rocky planets. And those rocky planets that are far enough away from the sun can collect the remaining gas that's there and form and become gas giants. So the point of the paper was that Jupiter, Uranus, Saturn, and Neptune are different from the gas giants that we're finding around other planetary systems. They form far out and drifted in, right? And see, drift is critical. If you get these planets drifting, it's game over for a life support planet. Its orbit will be disturbed if you've got a gas giant drifting anywhere near its location. So, okay, one other paper, and then we'll get into our lesson. This is in the Astrophysical Journal, published by a very famous theoretician, Scott Tremain. He was at Caltech when I was there. I remember him working on these problems at that time. But he says, there may be a second mechanism which might explain what we're seeing. And what he does is he's modeled the formation of these planetary systems in star clusters. And the rationale there is that all stars that are relatively young, and in that context our star is, quote, young because it's only 4.5 billion years old, and the universe is 13.7 billion years old. And so anything younger than the past 5 billion years would have the potential to form planets. If it's older than 5 billion years old, there simply isn't enough material heavier than helium to even make planetary formation possible. And that explains why all the planets we're finding are around relatively recently formed stars. But the point they make is these recently formed stars only form in star clusters. And if they form in star clusters, then we have to take into account the dynamics of a forming planetary system in the context of other stars that might gravitationally disturb it. And so what Scott Tremain determines is that if the star cluster is, quote, dense, then the close encounters with stars will increase the eccentricity of the planets. So he says another possible explanation for the high eccentricities is that you've got these close encounters with stars, and what he determines is a close encounter with a star, say a star coming near a planetary system out to the distance of Saturn, if a star were to come that close, or pardon me, you know, not even that close, if it comes even in Pluto distance, that passing of a star at the distance of Pluto to a planetary system will typically increase the eccentricity or the ellipticity of the orbits of all the planets in that system by 10 times, and can even increase it by 100 times. So he says this would increase the eccentricities of all the planets. And therefore, he says one of the ways we can put this to the test is when we're starting to see more planets, are they all elliptical, or do you see a variation in ellipticity like you do in our planetary system? Well, so far, every planetary system we've seen, this is where you've got multiple planets, they're all equally highly elliptical. So it does indicate that this star encounter thing may be a factor. Now, where do I stand on this? I think both of these research papers are valid, that you've got both mechanisms working together to increase the eccentricity of the stars. And so what Scott Tremain has come up with is an explanation for why there may be eccentricity there. The British astrophysicists are explaining why these stars may be closer in and have different chemical compositions than our planetary system. Either way, both sets of research results show that planets like Earth that are small, rocky, in close to their star, with circular orbits, with stable orbits, may be virtually non-existent. Ours would be the only one in that context. Yes. Right. In fact, well, a stellar encounter is less. Well, what Scott Tremain points out, and this is well established, that our sun did indeed form in a cluster of stars in the spiral arm, but was rapidly ejected from that system. In fact, when you look at the Big Dipper, those were partner stars to the sun when it formed. And as you look at the Big Dipper, those are stars that are flying apart at a pretty high rate. But our star, the Sun, was blown out of that star cluster faster than the rest of the stars. because, you know, the Big Dipper stars still form kind of a loose association. But ours is way out, huh? Well, what's typical is that a forming gas cloud, as it condenses, will form a bunch of stars. By a bunch, you know, 50 on up to maybe 300 stars. Yeah, with a dimension of about 10 light years. And so when you look at the Orion Nebula, that's an example of a big gas cloud forming dozens of stars that we can observe today in the formation stage. When you look at the Pleiades, that's the star cluster that formed about 100 million years ago. And it's still fairly tight, but is in the process of being dispersed by the gravitational tides of our galaxy. But the cluster in which our star formed was disturbed quickly. Now, astronomers have got an idea how that happened, namely these three supernova eruptions would have blown apart the cluster of stars fairly quickly, but evidently it sent our sun out at the highest velocity of all the stars. So we got ejected quite quickly from the system, which meant that there was an opportunity, therefore, for a different formation history for our solar system. Unlike these other planetary systems, where the eccentricity of planets was multiplied by stellar encounters, that wouldn't have happened in our solar system because we got ejected from the star cluster so quickly and put into a spot between two spiral arms rather than within the spiral arms. So that's one of the unique features of our solar system, is that things were set up, designed in such a way that this kind of history did not happen to our solar system. But the bottom line of all this new research, and by the way, this is brand new to just the last week, is that astronomers are making a complete turnaround, where they were concluding, because of all these extrasolar planets, that planets like Earth must be very common in our galaxy, to the recognition that they're exceptionally rare, and indeed we may be the only planetary system that could possibly harbor a planet with life on. I think there's life on our planet Earth. So, okay, any more questions, comments? Okay. By the way, you two gentlemen who thought this was a skeptics forum, if you've got a question, I'll take it. But we're going to have one next week. Yes. Bertrand? Yes. Yes. Well, come next week, Bertrand, because one of the papers I got here, I want to get into our text, but yeah, here it is. This is also in the Astrophysical Journal, and it's a paper that establishes that our galaxy is rare. It not only takes the just right star, the just right planetary system, you have to have the just right galaxy. So that's what I'm going to talk about next week as we open up our Skeptics Forum. Is a new research finding that establishes that not any old galaxy will do. It needs a very exquisitely designed galaxy for light to be possible in that galaxy. So hopefully it'll give you some motivation to come next week. And we live in a rare galaxy as well as a rare planetary system. Yes. Right.
So that in 15 billion years, or what, 11 billion years over long, this is going to have to happen so that this happens, so that these three explode exactly the same time. It's kind of stunning and thinking that I know we can't really attribute that to God.
No, that is a powerful apologetic point, and this is something I've been trying to talk about with people in the intelligent design movement. It's not just that we have the scientific evidence for very fine-tuned design. We have evidence for foresight. This design we're seeing demonstrates that there's someone behind the universe who had this all planned out in advance. And that's because things must happen at the just right times. It's not that they have to have these characteristics engineered in a just right way. That is a powerful argument for a supernatural creator. But I think what makes it especially compelling is how sensitive the timing is. And there are events that take place even in the first second of the universe that must be perfectly timed if there's going to be life 13.7 billion years later. And in the case of human beings, the window of time for allowing human civilization technology to flourish, by our calculations, is 20,000 years wide. British astrophysicists have given an independent calculation, say it's 41,000 years wide. But either way, it demonstrates that the Creator must bring human beings upon the terrestrial scene within a window that's no wider than 40,000 years. And if you miss the window, then you're not going to have beings like us. So if you're too late, it's not going to work. If you're too early, it's not going to work either. And when you put 40,000 years alongside of 13.7 billion years, you're talking about a 1 in a million hit on the timing. Yes, Kathy. Thank you for that analogy. Yeah, my wife Kathy is speaking from the experience of two teenage sons with six of their friends. You make a nice meal for them, put it on the table. What's the probability that all eight of those teenage boys will be ready to consume the food at the just right moment that it's put on the table? Zero. So, what's the probability that we human beings will be here at the just right time on planet Earth in the history of the universe, unless there is a supernatural creator? Likewise, virtually zero. Okay, but thank you for bringing that point out. And that's an argument that's often missed in Christian discussions about the Creator and the design of the Creator. It's the timing. The timing is what makes this such a compelling argument, and the fact that so many different things have to be timed just right. And by the way, we're working on a book where we're making the point that the timing of every species of life being introduced on planet Earth is critical for whether or not human beings will be able to develop technology. If you time the bacteria, the creation of certain bacterial species, if it's off ever so slightly, then we might be able to come upon the scene, but we'll never get out of the Stone Age. So all these different species of life over the past 3.8 billion years, they all have to be perfectly timed. And if you goof up the timing, then you lose out on the possibility of a human species with a high-tech civilization. Yes. No. Right. Right. Yes. Well, we've had human civilization now for 10,000 years. So if you're looking at the calculations by our scholar team, we got 10,000 years to go. Brandon Carter's team would say we got 30,000 years to go, maximum. But either way, it's not a lot of time. But it's still a window, yeah. I mean, one of the things they've discovered is that the sun has been exceptionally stable in its luminosity for the past 50,000 years. And that stability will only last another 50,000 years. And it's the only window of exceptional stability you get in the entire history of the sun. So once you get outside that window, then the sun is no longer as stable as it is now. So, yes. Okay, now, it's true. I mean, it's something we're putting in our Human Origins book. If you go back to Cain and Abel, they did have some level of civilization. Just based on the offerings they're able to bring before the Lord, they had some level of civilization. But when Brandon Carter or myself talks about human civilization, we're talking about where it reaches a point where people begin to specialize in their occupations, where you would have the first instance of a village of, say, a few thousand people that would totally devote themselves to pottery. And that requires a higher level of civilization than, say, what Cain and Abel enjoyed. They were basically engaged in mixed farming where they did a little bit of everything. Still very sophisticated. But no, what we're talking about is a level of sophistication and organization where you've got a village that's devoted to raising goats, a village that's devoted to raising wheat, and a village devoted to, say, developing pottery, another village devoted to the developing tools, and a transportation system so that they can trade goods. That level of civilization has only existed for the past 10,000 years. And from a biblical perspective, that level of civilization is necessary to take the good news of Jesus Christ to all the peoples of the world. So that's why, from a biblical perspective, God would want the human species to be able to quickly develop civilization and technology, because this is part of his plan to bring about the conquest of evil. Okay, let's get into the book of Job. Now, we've already been through Job 38, right? But what we've done in Job 38 is we've gone through the chapter and looked at how it reflects on the six creation days in Genesis 1. It's one of three chapters outside of Genesis that takes the six creation days of Genesis 1 and goes over it, bringing out details that are not brought out in Genesis chapter 1. And so that's been our study in Job 38 to date, is to go through the text, find those passages that reflect on each of these six creation days, and say, how does this help us gain greater understanding as to what was God doing during the six creation days? And we've had fun, because a lot of the things that Christians fight about, non-Christians dispute over the interpretation of Genesis 1, which of the interpretations is correct, is resolved here in Job 38. Now, stick with the class long enough, we're going to do that with Psalm 104. Psalm 104 gives even more detail on the six creation days than Job 38 does. And then Proverbs 8 does so to a lesser degree than these two chapters. The fourth place, of course, is Genesis chapter 1. But Job 38 and Psalm 104 are the most detailed of the passages in the Bible reflecting on the six creation days in Genesis 1. And together, Job 38 and Psalm 104 give more scientific detail on what God was bringing about than Genesis 1 does itself. Now, I just say that because when people start to get into fights over the interpretation of Genesis 1, it's good to remind them that Job 38 and Psalm 104 tell us a whole lot more than Genesis 1 does. You can get the tapes if you've missed out in our discussion. What we're going to do right now, and probably for the next couple of weeks, is to go through Job 38, because there's been this debate going on for 37 chapters. These five men, Job, his three friends, and then the silent young man Elihu, have been engaged in this 37-chapter debate over God and his creation. And that's something we've been bringing out, just how much it focuses on building a theology of God based on what you can see in the creation. But Job 38, it's like God has had enough and says, hey, let me ask you some questions. Because these five men are kind of reaching the conclusion, patting themselves in the back, look how much we figured out. And then God says, he answers Job out of the storm. But he's not just talking to Job, he's talking to all five men. He says, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Now, they had some knowledge, but they were missing a lot. And so what God does in chapter 38 is he asks these five men 60 questions. You can go through it. You can count 60 questions that he poses to these five men. And the 60 questions are basically a science test or a creation test. He asks them 60 questions about creation. And it's kind of embarrassing because for, 34 chapters they've been talking about creation. And then God jumps in and says, okay, you guys think you're so smart about this. I got 60 questions. And then they score themselves on the test. You know, Job answers after the test is over and basically says, I got a zero. But the other four men also got zeros. Not one of these 60 questions were they in a position to answer. Now, a question I thought would be good for us today would be to go through these 60 questions and say, well, how well can we do on these 60 questions? And, you know, we can kind of pat ourselves in the back because some of these 60 questions we can now answer. well, you'd expect, it's 35 to 3,600 years later. Surely we've learned something in 3,500 years that would put us at a superior advantage to these five men. But the thing that struck me was, of the 60 questions, today we can give adequate answers to 9 of the 60 questions. That leaves 51, where we're in the same spot as these five men, where we just say, we don't know anything about this. Okay? So, and you think of all these journals that we're reading and studying, and how much have we figured out? Well, we've gotten, 1/6 through the list of questions that God has raised. So in 3,500 years, how much have we really learned? Yeah, good thing it's not a 3-hour test, right? Yeah, we got another 30,000 years to go at best to get through this question. But the other thing I noted in going through this list is the 9 questions that we can answer all stand as evidence for the fulfillment of scientific prophecy. In other words, these 9 things are things that would have been impossible for anyone to know 3,000, 3,500 years ago. Today we know the answer. But in looking at that, each of these 9 gives us a powerful argument for the fact that the Bible indeed must be the inspired word of the Creator of the universe, because how else can we explain the fact that these statements that God gives, or these questions that God gives, and the answers that He implies to the questions have proven to be correct, far beyond the science of its day. So in Job 38, we've got 9 independent arguments that the Bible is the inspired word of God. And you know, at Fuller Seminary a few years ago, there was this debate. Is the Bible inerrant or is it inspired? And the crux of that debate was a redefinition of the term inspired. And it's actually in the doctrinal statement of Fuller Seminary today that we believe that the Bible is inspired without error in its communication in terms of faith and practice. But we're not saying that it's inerrant. Inerrant means that it's free of error or contradiction on all areas of interest, not just faith and practice issues, but science, history, geography. Whatever the Bible speaks on, we believe that it's trustworthy and reliable. Now that's kind of the inerrancy position. The inspiration position today, and by the way, this is a redefinition. 100 years ago, theologians saw no difference in the term between inspiration and inerrancy. It was a brand new distinction. But Job 38 is a wonderful place to go to show the Bible is not simply inspired when it addresses issues that pertain to faith and practice. It's also inspired and reliable and trustworthy, inerrant if you like, and when it speaks on science, history, and geography. Because, look, it's saying things about science that were thousands of years ahead of its time, and now we know it is true. Okay, with that as an introduction, let's jump into it. I thought one wonderful assignment I could give all of you is to read through Job 38 and pick out the 60 questions. If you want, you can do that for homework, but I'm not going to force you to do that. Not that I ever could anyway. But the quiz really starts in verse 4. Verse 1, then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. So that's how he starts off the quiz. And so I can just see these five men all properly braced, wondering how many questions they're going to be able to answer that the Lord throws at them, and they don't answer a single one. Well, the first question he throws out at them is, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. So the question is, do we understand how God laid the earth's foundations? Well, you've heard me kind of talk about it just with some of these new scientific discoveries. And keep in mind, we're talking 3,500 years after this was probably recorded. And what we're saying is, well, we think it's pebbles that get stuck together by these barbecue tars to make rocks that stick together, to make planetesimals that stick together to make rocky planets. And then the ones that are far enough away collect gas that's out there and then make the gas giants. But I think the Lord had more in mind than just some simplistic statement about pebbleization. He says, do you really understand exactly how it was that I formed planet Earth and the rest of the solar system? And, you know, we can give a better answer than the five gentlemen that were sitting there taking this test. But I don't think this idea about pebbles sticking together to make rocks is really what the Lord had in mind when he said, do you really understand how I formed planet Earth? No, we got just kind of the beginnings of a glimpse of how God pulled it off. We really don't have deep understanding. But I would admit we're a little farther along than the five gentlemen. Right. Well, I think that's implied in the question, this whole issue we're bringing up here about timing. Okay, where were you? I mean, I was there, the Lord says. I laid the foundation. A little later on, he's going to make the point, and the angels saw me do this, but you weren't there. So the angels saw how God pulled it off. So in one sense, these astrophysicists could say, you know what? Rather than trying to figure out this pebbleization thing, maybe I just need to talk to an angel who was there and ask him. Okay? That'd be another way to do it. Verse 7. While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy as God was laying down these foundations of the earth. So yeah, that's a good point. None of us were there to see it. We can kind of indirectly look back in time and figure out a little bit of it. But again, this pebble concept, it's not accepted by all astrophysicists. We don't have a deep understanding. I don't think you can give a score on that one and say we've got it figured out. Okay? Right. Yeah, this is all created for you. Well, what you see in the New Testament is that even before God had created the universe, he determined the day that you would be born. He had determined the day that you would die. And according to Ephesians, he had laid out good works in advance for you to do in between that day that you were born and that day that you would die. I mean, that's kind of mind-boggling to think about. 13.7 billion years ago, before God even created space and time, he determined when I would be born, when I would die, and he'd also lay out in advance all these good works for me to do for his purpose and his glory. That was all on his calendar more than 13.7 billion years ago. Pretty mind-boggling. Right. Right, right. Incredible detail. Every day. Okay. So that's one question I don't think we would get a good score on. Verse 5. He takes it into a little deeper sense. He says, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me you understand. Verse 5, who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? So one of the points he makes of these five men is, you don't even know how big this thing is. You have no idea what its dimensions are. Well, how about us today? Do we really know how big the universe is? Well, when we look back in time, when you look far away, you're looking back in time, but you're looking back to an era when the universe was smaller. No astronomer today really knows what the dimensions of the universe are. Why? Because those dimensions are beyond the horizon beyond which we can observe. The velocity of light limits how far we can look out. And so astronomers make a distinction. We talk about the actual universe and the observable universe. And the laws of physics limit how much of the universe we can actually see. So in this context, who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched out a measuring line across it? We do not know the answers to those questions. Moreover, it's really a point where we will never know. Because of the laws of physics, there is no capacity, at least on this side of glory, of ever knowing what these dimensions for the universe really are. Yes. I think it refers to both, because, you know, here it brings in the morning stars, the angels shouting for joy. I think there's a large context and a small context, but in that one, I don't think we got a good answer to that either. Why is planet Earth the dimensions that it has? Has any astrophysicist figured out how you make an Earth that's the size that the Earth is. I mean, we've got a good understanding how to make planets smaller and how to make planets larger, but one of the big mysteries is planet Earth. Planet Earth has this huge density, it's the densest object in the solar system, and it has a size that it's enigma to us. Now we're getting some understanding for it, that the Earth was actually smaller but got to a bigger mass because of this Mars-sized body colliding with it, and so it got pushed up to a little bigger mass than what our mathematics would suggest. But then you begin to figure out, well, how do you explain this Mars-sized body? How did it get its collision path? And oh, how did that Mars-sized body form? Now we're getting into mysteries that we haven't yet plumbed. So it's like the first question. We're a little further ahead, but we're not really coming with satisfying total answers yet. That's true. We do know, we can measure the size of the Earth. But I think a deeper question that the Lord is asking here is, who marked off the dimensions? How do you explain the fact that the Earth is the size it is? How do you explain its density, the fact that it's so much denser than the other planets? How do you explain its thin atmosphere? It should have a really thick atmosphere. It doesn't. And again, these are questions that we're beginning to probe and develop some answers. I mean, we got an idea why our atmosphere is now so much thinner than Venus's atmosphere, thanks to this Mars-sized body colliding with us. But what's interesting about these questions, these inklings that we're getting tell us what? God had to be involved. I mean, the only way you're going to get Earth with the dimensions that it has, with the density that it has, with the atmospheres that it has, is if you have all this exquisite fine-tuned design. And you're going to see that in every one of these 60 questions, is that where we do have a little bit of inkling of understanding, that inkling is revealing to us God in a way that was not revealed to us in the past. So what I'm going to kind of do here, we're running out of time, as we go through Job 38, is go through these 60 questions, and we're going to see that it's either predictive apologetics, proof that the Bible was predicting future scientific discoveries thousands of years ahead of its time, or where we have an inkling of understanding, is going to show us evidence for design that we didn't have before. And then the third point, where we have no understanding at all, it just shows us how lowly and humble our position is relative to God and what he pulled off. And therefore, that's kind of the theme of the next few weeks as we go through Job 38. And incidentally, I've already kind of announced what we're going to do in Job 39. One of the 60 questions just simply poses, do you understand the soulish aspects of the birds and the mammals? Just one question. Let me see if I can find it here for you. It says, who endowed the heart with wisdom or gave understanding to the mind? And here I believe it's making a reference not just to human beings, but birds and mammals. They have a heart with emotional reactions. They have a mind. And in Job 39, it just talks about a whole bunch of animals whose mind and heart don't seem to make any sense from our perspective, like a horse charging into battle, or an ostrich running away from the eggs it has laid. But as we dig into this, we realize, aha, there really is a reason for why God created these creatures with a mind and the heart that they have. But the question he raises, do you really have any understanding? It's kind of an unexplored region of Christian apologetics, looking at the soulish creation rather than just the physical creation for evidence for God's handiwork. With that, let's bow for some closing prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you, Lord, for ensuring that this book would be in our Bible, for Job and his three friends and the young man Elihu and their discussion, and how you guided that discussion and then intervened here in the 38th chapter. Lord, this is incredibly rich in tools that we can exploit to persuade people that we know that this book really is from you. It's inspired, it's inerrant, and there's a message here that we all need to listen to so that we can develop a right relationship with you and with one another. So Lord, continue to give us rich insights into this text and continue to give us opportunities to share your wisdom with people that we meet. In Jesus' name, amen.